Welcome to Committee Corridor, where parliamentary select committees go about the business of asking the tough questions that need to be asked, holding Her Majesty's government to account, but also investigating the questions that are prominent today. The Committee Corridor is a real place. It runs the length of the Palace of Westminster, all the way from the Lords down to the end of the Commons. Open any door and you'll find MPs and, of course, some Lords working across political parties to learn from experts and practitioners. We want to know where the government's policies are working, where they're not, and where things can be done better. I'm Tom Tugendhat. I chair the Foreign Affairs Committee, and today we're returning to the war in Ukraine, this time, though, through the eyes of the Baltic states, as well, of course, of our own. Latvia and Estonia are two fellow NATO members that sit on the border with Russia. We'll be discussing their security concerns following the invasion of Ukraine, NATO's response to the crisis, and what the coming months may bring for the Baltic region and for Europe. In a moment, I'm going to be talking to the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of Estonia, Marko Mikkelson, and he's going to be joined by Tobias Elwood, who is the chair of the UK Defence Committee and Conservative MP for Bournemouth East. But first, I'm pleased to be joined by Rihard Kols, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Latvian Parliament. Welcome to Committee Corridor. Rihard, thank you very much for joining us. There are reports that the Russian Duma is discussing repealing Russia's recognition of Latvia's independence. Now, as well as Estonia and Lithuania and Ukraine, that would be an extraordinary reversal of post-Soviet Russian policy. What's your response to these claims? And do you see this as a major step up in Russia's provocation of Baltic countries?
Well, it comes with no surprise. I mean, constantly since we regained our independence in the 90s, the all three Baltic countries have experienced this kind of rhetorical bullying from Russian politicians, particularly in Russian Duma. And, you know, ironically, I could say that these kind of statements and remarks, because I haven't heard that, you know, certain legislation have been submitted. It's a rhetoric that is coming from certain MPs in Russian Duma. And I think, you know, we know that not that recently, one prominent politician of Russian Duma passed away. And I think the world became a better place, and that's Vladimir Zhirinovsky. And I think, you know, somebody is just trying to fill in his shoes and maybe take a credit and use these kind of slur, you know, rhetorics and announcements. So therefore, I mean, that obviously has to be regarded. And of course, it has to be counter, you know, argued and not to go into depths about that. So the revisionism, as we see, is still topical for Russia in so many different ways, and, you know, the plans in a way as well. So we're not taking this as, you know, something with great concern. And if they do, okay. They easily recognize occupied territories as independent countries and etc. And, you know, it not necessarily mean the international community is on the same page with them.
Well, you can be certain that we're not going to recognize any claims against Latvia. You can be absolutely certain of that.
Yeah, we stick with the sane part of the world. So, but of course, those are provocative announcements. And we should not be surprised. But I would not say that should instantly raise some dramatic alarms.
And so, I mean, it does really make it very clear how sensible your government was all those years ago to join NATO alongside Estonia and Lithuania. And now, of course, the talk is of NATO membership for Sweden and Finland, which I personally welcome enormously. But what difference do you think that will make to your security and to the security of other Baltic countries?
It's of massive importance. We've been advocating on different levels for years with our Swedish colleagues, Finnish colleagues as well on the membership. Whenever I met my MP's colleagues, I said, when is the day? When are you going to submit? Because we're ready to support it. But if we look in real time, you know, terms, we see that the Sweden and Finland already cooperates with NATO 95% on the level of 95%. The cooperation is there. Of course, for them becoming a full-fledged member state of NATO, that absolutely gives a much more robust security dimension in the Baltic region and the Baltic Sea region. No wonder that someone in these days, when Sweden and Finland submitted the application, stated that it's no more the Baltic Sea, it's a NATO Sea. So this is important.
So in your view, is the diplomacy that we've seen between Western countries directly with Russia, directly with President Putin over issues like unblocking Ukrainian ports and food security, is that appropriate? Or do you think that's bringing him into a conversation that, frankly, he shouldn't be part of?
I mean, it is clear you cannot have a dialogue or, you know, a proper mutually respectful discussion with a tyrant, with a war criminal. I mean, it's the numerous countries that have recognized the atrocities the Russian army is conducting on Ukrainian soil as the war crimes, as a genocide in the case of Latvia as well. And in this time to say that we have to still, no matter what, sit down and talk to this tyrant. Again, we tried that since beginning of December when Russia put forward ultimatums. We actually, honestly, the West was willing to engage and talk. In the end, what we saw actually, all that was pre-staged. He knew already that he will launch a full-scale attack on Ukraine, no matter what, you know, ultimatums we would met or fulfill and etc., make or any concessions. So therefore, right now, with the talks on grain, it should be done between Ukraine and Russia on terms only for them to be determined. So therefore, I know the international community is working and trying to find a ways how to get grain out of Ukraine. And it's not necessarily always all the options are only when Russia is involved. There are other options as well. And we should, you know, more focus on those options rather than, you know, trying to find ways to convince Russia. I don't think it's a very plausible thing to do.
Well, you've also, you just touched on it now, you've also declared, I think in April, Latvia declared that it was a genocide in Ukraine and that the war was of that level of brutality. What was the rationale behind the decision, and what do you think are the practical implications of making such a strong statement, not just today, but actually over coming years?
Well, you see, we have suffered from the same aggressor. The Latvia as a country in the past, in the 20th century, by the Soviet Union. And, you know, as Russian Federation has claimed, they are the successor of the Soviet Union. And what we see, the Russian army in Ukraine, in the first days, in the first weeks, the information coming out of Ukraine, the atrocities they're committing against the civilians, particularly targeting civilians, it doesn't much, you know, differ from how the Red Army, the Soviet Army, conducted their atrocities on our soil during the Second World War and committed also the crimes. The difference is at that time, after the Second World War, nobody was taken to the trial from the Soviet Army and Red Army. And here we saw the first reports when apparently Russia was really suffering huge losses and starting to pull back their troops. And of course, claiming that is a good faith kind of signal to create these green corridors and etc. and to make, you know, a feasible way for the talks. But what we saw when the Russian troops withdraw from the occupied territories in Ukraine after the 24th of February, the huge atrocities, the war crimes they have committed in Bucha, in Irpin. I mean, the whole world saw that. And on top of that, what we see, Russia is also violating, I mean, numerous international laws. And they are forcibly deporting Ukrainians, not only ethnic Ukrainians, but Ukrainians by nationality, to the Far East of Russia. Again, I mean, we have still very fresh memory on that. Despite it's been more than 60 years, the huge deportations of Latvians to Siberia. And when we regained our independence, we adopted the resolution on the Latvia's occupation, where we see the deportations of 1941 and 1949 conducted by the Soviet Union as a genocide. So therefore, it is our moral duty to recognize these atrocities, these actions that Russia is conducting in Ukraine as a genocide. Yes, there will be those who will argue that it's only by court to be decided if that has been a genocide or not. But you see, there is UN Charter as well that stipulates that UN member states, if they witness even slightest indications that there is a genocide being conducted, we have to do utmost we can to stop it. So therefore, I'm pleased that the Baltic countries have done that. Canada has done that as well, recognize it. And this is, you know, what the signal we should send also to Russia and the Russian army. no matter how long the time will go, you will be punished for your crimes that you have committed. So the principle of not avoiding the punishment had to be adopted. And therefore, we also call for international tribunal to be adopted as well.
Well, look, I think you make a very powerful point that this is horrible echoes of your own experience and, of course, of Lithuania's and Estonia's experience during the occupation, during the Soviet occupation. Can I just ask, though, about our own preparedness? Because, of course, a lot has been made of the fact that the West, the United Kingdom, the United States has been relatively quick to respond to Ukrainians' need for assistance, both in terms of military technology, but also in terms of intelligence. What do you think are the lessons for us about European security preparedness and the structures that we've built over the years, some NATO, some others, in making sure that we're able to answer the challenges that the aggression that, that Putin has thrown at us? And do you think that Europe and the United States are sharing intelligence well enough to make sure that we're ready to face these aggressions ever again?
What's happening in Ukraine, and before the 24th of February, there was for the first time actually very directly publicly indicated what info the intelligence community in the U.S. is having on the potential Russian plans, and really publicly confronted Russia. And we see that it didn't play, but it played when it came to the Western countries as well. I mean, I do not doubt the capabilities of our intelligence services. The cooperation, I wish would be much, stronger and closer. There has been divisions in the past, sharing the intelligence that has led to terrorist attacks on the European continent that could have been avoided if the intelligence community within the NATO and EU would more actively cooperate with each other. So therefore, the security dimension, yes, after 2014 there and 2016 summit as well, there has been a lot of stepping up, reinforcing the eastern flank. But what we're seeing right now for the past 2 years, the decisions made in 2016 are not anymore playing as a deterrent. It's not enough. I mean, the masses of troops that Russia is concentrating on the eastern flank is totally, outnumbering what we are having on our side. So therefore, there is a urgent need to reinforce the eastern flank, the Baltic countries as well. And what we are seeing, and of course, we are closely following the how Russia is conducting its war in Ukraine. What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses? And we obviously see that the air defense in case of Ukraine is vulnerability number one. And well, I will not lie, that is the same case when it comes to the Baltic countries. We don't have proper air defense systems, none at all, not at all. So therefore, this is something where immediately NATO needs to put their heads together and come up with a solution that's at least for the medium term to really abolish these kind of threats and have the potential to defend. So therefore, of course, the size, and we have the battle group station, as you mentioned, UK is covering a framework country for Estonia. Latvia is being taken care of by Canada, also good friends, and Lithuania by Germany. And in this scenario, we see that the security dimensions have dramatically changed because it's not only Russia that is conducting a war in Ukraine. The accomplice is Belarus. And as the Western world has decided in a way of assessing the falsified elections or stolen elections in 2020, illegitimate President Lukashenko, he has, in our view, from our point of view, Belarus is no more sovereign state. It's already absolutely dependent on Russia in so many ways. I mean, military-wise, 100%. So therefore, the Russian troops on the Belarus soil, having potential military permanent bases and so on, that is, again, a totally new security dimension for us.
When we were talking last, there were two NATO meetings coming up. And then we recently had the one in Bucharest, I think a few months back. Is there more that you were hoping out of those meetings? Because as we look towards Madrid, I mean, clearly the focus is on the membership of Sweden and Finland, which we hope will go through. I know there are obstacles, but we hope it'll go through pretty soon. But it can't just be that. It really does have to be a focus on realizing that we cannot allow even one town in Latvia to be occupied by a barbarous army like the Russian army today.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we have this famous saying by President Biden, not an inch of NATO soil will be taken. It will be protected. You know, for Latvians, inch is already too much. You know, we have in a metric system, so we talk in millimeters. Inch is way too much already. So, but no, in all seriousness, the Bucharest 9, of course, we are the frontier for NATO, external border. The reinforcements, I mean, we do welcome the creation of the battle groups in Romania and Slovakia as well. Obviously, that is needed to be done, but we have to speak on the physical threats that are really near at our borders and reinforcements. And I think it is a point where we have to speak about burden sharing within NATO. Latvia and the Baltic countries, if I'm not mistaken, we have already decided to increase our defense expenditure up to 2.5% from our GDP. And, you know, I told you already in the short term, the necessities that we need, air defense systems. And you know better than all, those are costly things, very costly. Even if we combine the whole Baltic countries' defense budget, we could not afford a proper system in place. So therefore, I think it's time also to speak within the NATO as well, burden sharing. We have certain member states that, you know, they're not in frontier and, you know, their army may be size of 400 troops and an army. But again, if they are really applying to this 2% from the GDP, that sum of requirement can be also attributed to strengthen the defense capabilities on the eastern flank as well.
There's no more role more important than defending your country. And you know that you have very, very strong allies here in the United Kingdom. Richard, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you.
I'm now joined by Marko Mikkelson, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Estonian Parliament, and my friend and fellow Select Committee Chair, Tobias Elwood. He's a Conservative MP for Bournemouth East and chairs the Defence Committee. Marko, what has been the response of the Estonian people to the Russian reinvasion of Ukraine? How has your politics been affected by this wanton act of aggression?
Actually, to be honest and frank, we started to support heavily Ukraine already 8-9 years ago. Then Russia started actually invasion against Ukraine with occupying and annexing Crimea and then later on starting the war invasion in eastern Ukraine. But after Putin mounted a new threat against Ukraine already last year, our policy was very clear and straightforward and shared politically, but also very strongly within a society as well. So we were ready already at the end of last year to supply additional weaponry or help to Ukraine, because for us was clear that Putin is going to invade or reinvade Ukraine, and Ukraine needs strong help from allies, partners from the West. There is very clear and general understanding that the threat posed by Russia and a war launched against Ukraine is war against all of us, and we have to commonly fight back.
Now, Tobias, I know that, you know, a lot of the work that we've been doing has been on foreign affairs, but the reality is the overlap between our two committees here is enormous. I was wondering, though, if you could look at the defense perspective and tell us, how do you see the Russia-Ukraine crisis? And how do you rate our government's response to Russian aggression in Ukraine? And what conclusions have you already drawn about the UK's defence policy?
Well, Tom, thanks for including me. And Marko, great to see you. I was recently at the Leonard Murray Security Conference, and it's only when you go to the Baltics do you really feel a very different sense of security concerns than perhaps we enjoy over here. And this is the big question that you ask, Tom. I remember you and I gave some pretty big speeches in the summer when we departed from Afghanistan. And I made the case there after, you know, your very powerful speech, where I suggested that this was perhaps the tipping point, the high tide mark of Western liberalism after the Second World War. We've enjoyed 30 years of relative peace since the last Cold War. We've become a little risk averse. And I think what we're seeing with Russia is a huge wake-up call, a real shake-up on European security. Don't forget, we've got a China that's supporting Russia there. Putin has been clever in working out what to do, probably surprised by the scale of response by the Ukrainians, but he probably got it right, the fact that the West remains rather hesitant to really go toe-to-toe with Russia for all the reasons that no doubt we're going to discuss. It's so important that we ensure that we encourage and support Ukraine to make sure that they can win rather than just stop them from losing.
Now, of course, in those early days, the UK was able to deploy anti-tank weapons very quickly. Those NLAWs went in just before the Russians attacked. How have you been assessing the UK's defence contribution to this conflict?
I think Britain's excelled itself, but we must recognise that our relationship with Ukraine goes back to 2014. This isn't just a one-off event that Russia is involved in now. There's actually a conveyor belt of events that are taking place going back to Georgia, then to the Crimea, and of course, Donbass as well. This is what Putin does. And I was pleased to see us get involved early on. What we've done is turn the tap on even further to actually provide ever greater quality and quantity of weapon systems. And that's really good to see. I would love to see our NATO friends match the same commitment that we are doing in Britain.
That raises, of course, interesting questions because, of course, the pattern doesn't just echo itself in the South, as you've just identified, but Russia and President Putin in particular has made claims to protect only in the sense of a mafia don protecting, of course, but to protect the Russian-speaking populations in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And of course, in Estonia, I think it's about a quarter of the population is ethnically Russian. Are there fears in Estonia that these people could be exploited by President Putin? Are you seeing a rise in disinformation campaigns? Marco, you've spoken out very clearly against Russian psyops, as it were, psychological operations in the past. How are you seeing it today?
Actually, to be frank, this is nothing new for us. You know, as a journalist in mid-90s, and I worked as a Moscow correspondent and also covered the first Chechen war, you know, sometimes I think that that time, Russians' rhetoric against the Baltic states was much more emotional, threatening, because remember, we weren't that time the members of NATO. They threatened us to occupy, they threatened us to kill, they threatened us to send all the nation population out of Estonia and other Baltic nations to Siberia. So, and this is why actually we are today as nation and society more resilient, seeing what's coming from Russia, because unfortunately, you know, my own personal experience from Chechnya, from 95, 96, when I saw what Russians did with their own citizens, Chechens, they demolished the center of Krosny, the same size of town like Mariupol, to the, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people were perished that time. And that was the signal, at least to me, already that time. And nobody knew even about Putin, that Russia is unfortunately going after their imperial ambitions or try to restore somehow the glory of old Russian Empire. Unfortunately, failure of us collectively, the Western nations, to understand the seriousness and long-term strategy or kind of embedded or, you know, like I say, the deeply embedded in their DNA will and desire for empire. This is what we hear from, you know, latest statements of Putin. And he says that he wants to be more than time Peter the Great. But saying that, I think that the response of our nations, Estonia, UK, in Estonia, by the way, we are very, very thankful what your government has done, both reassuring us as a bordering nation to Russia and the ally within NATO, and the British troops and presence in Estonia is remarkable and very well welcomed by our people, but also your leadership and very clear positioning in terms of what we should do as allies, democratic allies, fighting back this Russian aggression.
Is there more that we should be doing, Tobias? Because we've looked at the response to Ukraine as in many ways it's bilateral. Yes, I know we're all NATO countries, but actually NATO has not been the enabling organization. It's been bilateral aid to Ukraine. Do you think this should be a NATO operation, or do you think, as many have argued, this should be a bilateral operation because making it into a NATO one would be to fall into Putin's propaganda?
Do you have the most formidable, potent military alliance ever assembled across the world in our history, and yet it's not leaning in to support Ukraine? There's a fire in Ukraine and NATO will not put it out. And the big question is whether that fire is going to get worse and eventually NATO will have a bigger fire to deal with. And that's the question that we have to ask ourselves. Unfortunately, the way it works at the moment, it's done by consensus. Therefore, there's the ability of two or three nations able to prevent NATO's formally engaging and going toe-to-toe with Russia. Now, you say, would that be, you know, provoking Russia itself? But let's not forget that Russia is doing the provoking. Russia did the invading in a European democracy. And arguably, you could see why the Ukrainians are frustrated to be on NATO's doorstep and not see the military might be greater utilized to help to put this particular fire out. So that then begs the question that you've implied as to whether there should be a coalition of the willing, maybe, you know, a part of NATO that can better coordinate our activities to support the Ukrainian people. But I just wrote back a bit to what Marco was saying, because we've not asked that more fundamental question. Where is Russia going with all this in the longer term? Now, we have our prism is often through our timeline is through election cycles, sometimes even news cycles. That's about as far as ahead in the future that we look at. But we know that Russia and China think on a different scale. If you can do something better in 3 or 4 years time than you can today, well, absolutely wait. And if what Russia or Putin specifically has worked out that this is going to be China's century, that authoritarianism is actually on the rise, that the West itself is no longer able to police the international rules-based order, then I believe he's made the calculation after Afghanistan, you know, going back to where we retreated from there, handing that back to the very insurgency that we went into defeat, to make his mark, as Marco was saying, to actually go back and try and spread his influence across the Slavic section of Europe, knowing that China has got its back. And that is the big challenge for us to wake up to. That is the big geopolitical, geostrategic challenge that we need to embrace ourselves.
Now, Prime Minister Kaja Kallas of Estonia has said that NATO needs warfighting capabilities and permanent bases in Estonia. And she's also spoken about having them in other Baltic states. Do you think this troop presence, this increased troop presence, because of course there is already a British permanent presence in Estonia, do you think that would be helpful, or do you think it would be seen by Russia as aggressive? How do you view it, Marco?
Absolutely not. Of course, we have to make sure with our both political statements, but also most importantly, what we do in order to bolster deterrence measures. We are more or less happy in terms of presence numbers. Of course, we would like to see a little bit more, but those are already details. And most important, what we're looking forward, of course, is that everything what we build up in Estonia or in other Baltic states as well, they have to be combat ready. They have to be seen by Russian strategists or for, you know, Putin himself, that any attempt to test Article 5 in our region is going to be catastrophic for attacker. But, you know, all those talks about what provokes or what doesn't provoke Putin, please forget about that, because whatever we do, they find the ways to launch their own sort of activities. And I think what also Tobias said, that this has been a general wake-up call for all of us. And also today, what has happened in Ukraine and the Russia's war, heavy, brutal, genocidal war in the middle of Europe today and 21st century, we have to understand that this is a point where we have to finally become proactive, put together a strategy which really leads us to the strategic defeat of Russia in this war.
Can I ask, Tobias, because this is already now 4 months into what looks to be increasingly a drawn-out conflict. I mean, one of the concerns that people have raised is war fatigue. And of course, the immediate one is the one that we're seeing in the news. It's less widely covered. It's not gone away, but it's less widely covered. And then, of course, when we get to the winter, when we get to October, the pressure that will be there on governments across Europe to somehow resolve the energy issue that will no doubt be increasing. Do you think that we're prepared for the long term for Ukraine? Do you think we're ready for the cost that this is going to cause on our communities and our homes and families?
Yeah, I think Ukraine fatigue is the biggest issue here. I mean, I touched on that strategic patience that we don't seem to have and that Russia does. I mean, if you are the last man standing as an aggressor, then you've won. You could throw everything at it, happy to lose personnel, equipment, and so forth. But if you've got the territory at the end of the day and had the patience, you will win. So there are really big questions for us to sell this, if you like, as to why Ukraine is important. Marco said this, is that it's actually Ukrainians doing the fighting for Europe. We ask ourselves, why is there a cost of living crisis here? Why are food prices high here? It's because the grain can't get out the country. It's as simple as that. And it's not just coming supporting here in Britain. It's across Europe as well. German beer, for example, is now affected, going up in prices because the malt, you know, comes originally from Ukraine. But there are other countries also that are going to probably experience famine. Egypt, Somalia, Lebanon, places like this. What's going to the geopolitical consequences of us not making sure that port remains open are absolutely huge. And then there's wider questions as well. We are gifting so much weapon systems, but that's having a huge bearing on our own quartermaster stores, on our own cupboards, if you like, of equipment that we have. We're not able to replace those in the speed that we need to. So we also become vulnerable. And then there's big questions about what does our defense posture as a whole look like? The integrated review saw us reduce our own troop numbers by 10,000. Now, we've got two battle groups now in Estonia. I hope that they're going to remain there, just as we had during the Cold War. We had that line in Germany. We now need to make sure that line moves eastwards, includes Finland and Sweden, but of course the Baltics too. But if you're going to keep replenishing battle groups, you need the troops. And at the moment, we've reduced our troop numbers. Huge questions, not just for NATO, but for Britain as well, in recognizing that security, geopolitical, you know, our security across Europe is on the demise.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed for that, Tobias. Marco, one last question, if I may. If you look forward, how do you see the future relationship between the Baltic states, between Estonia in particular, and Russia? Is there a possibility to hope for a peaceful future? Are there steps we could take that could get us there?
This is a very provocative question. Going back into history, yes, we had better or not so good times, but I think with Putin's Russia, we won't have normal relations, not only between Estonia or Russia, but Western countries and Russia. How the hell we can sit behind the same table with war criminal? This is unimaginable. And that brings us to the point why it is so essential today coordinate better and help Ukraine to win their independence war, because this is nothing else than the independence war for Ukraine, which was inevitable, actually, from very beginning of Soviet Union after the Soviet Empire collapsed, because the future of both Russia, Ukraine, but the entire Europe is very much connected to this. Is Russia going to be a, let's say, normal country without imperial ambitions? Or not? We see today they have very, very vivid imperial ambitions for what they use massive conventional force. And the only possible way to build peaceful and stable Europe with possibly peaceful relations between Western countries and Russia is that this kind of Czechist, KGBist Russia must go.
Well, Marco, look, thank you very much indeed for joining us on this podcast on Committee Corridor. It's wonderful to have you with us. And Tobias, thank you very much for being here. It's really good to have your voice on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next time, I'm going to be speaking to Richard Ratcliffe about his campaign, eventually, thank God, successful, to secure the release of his wife, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, from a prison in Iran. I'll be asking him why he thought that Parliament could help and how. And once he'd knocked on the door of his MP, did that help to open any other doors? We'll be talking about the role that committees can play in relation to detentions, or what we should be calling hostage taking. I'm Tom Tugendhat. I chair the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, and you've been listening to Committee Corridor. Thank you for joining us, and if you've enjoyed it, please don't forget to subscribe to us, and of course, rate and review us. It helps others to find the podcast.